The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the first ever Guardian Book Club in Manchester. We're at the University of Manchester with a man who could claim at this particular moment in time to be one of that city's most distinguished literary sons. He is Howard Jacobson and he was born there in 1942. He has, of course, been shortlisted for the Booker Prize for his latest novel, The Finkler Question, but it's not that book that we're going to be discussing. As our book club supremo John Mullen explains, we don't do the latest novel, but one that everyone has had time to read and reread.
We're taking, Howard, not too far back down memory lane. We're taking 4 years to talk about Kaluki Nights, which was published in 2006. So I want to start off, Howard, talking about the relationship between you and this guy who tells a story, actually, because I sort of kept hearing sometimes in his throwaway, in Max's throwaway thoughts and observations and sardonic sayings, you, really.
Well, he doesn't have to be close to me at all for you nonetheless to be hearing me. I mean, the two things can be. He doesn't have to be me. I don't have to have done any of the things that my hero Max has done or even thought any of the things that he thinks, though that would be unusual. I made Max a cartoonist. And I made Max a cartoonist because I did very consciously want to put my mind, for reasons that we'll go on to talk about, to comedy. One of the things that this novel is an argument about the importance of comedy. And you will have heard me because it's something I talk about all the time. The comic and the serious are not to be divided. I actually like to go further and say if you want to be really serious, you're going to have to be comic to do it. And if you're not, if there isn't some comedy somewhere or other, then you will have failed of the ultimate seriousness. That's one of the things I like to say, and it's something that I let Max like to say as well. So I've made Max a cartoonist who's written a history called 2,000 Years of Bitterness, a comic history of the Jewish people, which of course doesn't sell, because who is it that would want to buy that? But in his anger at the fact that it doesn't sell, we've got all that play around play and what's comic and what's serious. So yes, that's me all right.
And you make him quite sententious or quite opinion. I mean, he states, he narrates, but there's a lot of opinions. He says, I little by little rebel from the extravagant, the optimistic fantasy of the comic books. English culture called, if not the English comic book, then the English cartoon. Moralistic, suspicious, doer, savage, reductively ribald, everything that I was not. I mean, I hear you. Analyzing and even sort of recommending.
Yes, but I'm also in an argument with those words because that passage comes when he's talking about what it was like first to see American comic books and to have those wonderful architectural drawings of Superman flying through the sky. Wonderful. I mean, it was like looking at, you know, Tintoretto's or something or other. Marvelous, powerful colored frames. Superman is saving the world. Superman, you read a Superman comic and Superman is spinning the world on its axis. He's jumping across galaxies and things. And then you look at English comics, the Dandy and the Beano. And it's all about, you know, you put a bucket of water on the door so that it falls on the teacher's head and that's victory. And it was that feeling that the English imagination can feel if you compare these two things, so shrunken. So although I do use the word reductive there, I mean, reductive is not a word that one can use admiringly. I'm in a way admiring something about the English, but also at that moment saying how much I feel I don't naturally possess as an English writer, as someone that inherits English culture, I am reduced in some way. And I'm conscious of that, although I'm steeped in English culture. I'm a reader of English literature. I'm more English literature than I'm anything else. But as a Jew from Manchester, then I feel I'm the heir to other traditions of vigour and noise. If you're Jewish, you're noisy. If you're from Manchester, you're noisy and sarcastic. So to have them both together is a great gift. And I feel that's part of what I'm on earth to do, really, which is to, you know, give the world, which is moralistic and reductive and meagerly ribald, this other grander, noisier thing. And that's one of the things that the book's about.
Is it true that you described it as the most Jewish novel that's ever been written anywhere?
Yeah, that's one of those things you kind of, you say these things. you can't say anything now because of the internet. Yeah. Because you say a thing in some little gathering, anything I say here, of course, potentially could be with me for the rest of my life. And I didn't mean to be saying anything earth-shattering or final by it, but it did just occur to me as I was writing it. And I remember shouting down to my wife, I think I might be writing the most Jewish book ever. And she said, are you, darling? And what And that was because I thought, well, if we did a Jew count, the word Jew appears on more lines than of any other. I mean, yes, and I bet this would hold. I bet the Jew occurs on more lines in this book than it does in the Old Testament.
But you have some sentences in the novel which up the count artificially, because you have sentences which go Jew, 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 Jew.
Well, that's an important thing too, yes. Jew, Jew, Jew. I mean, it's about not being able to get Jew out of your head. It's a book about obsession. So it's very Jewish to that degree, and it's a book about someone who is obsessed with being Jewish. I mean, just in case any of you were thinking that you might say, aren't you a bit obsessed with being Jewish in this book? Let's, you know, I'll save you that question. I am obsessed with being Jewish. More importantly, or at least I was obsessed with being Jewish when I wrote this book, my hero is obsessed with being Jewish, and it's about being obsessed with being Jewish. But it's also a very Jewish book in another way, in that I did very consciously want to set against... I mean, that's a wonderful quote that you gave there, those adjectives, because that's kind of one of the walls that I wanted to scale in this book.
This is something that maybe we have encountered before, but not in English novels, but in American novels. I mean, that there are Philip Roth novels that this might remind you of, that there is actually a kind of precedent for the sort of... the obsessive exuberance you talk about in American fiction.
Yes, there is, but it's different. I mean, when I wrote my first novel... my first novel came out, people compared me to Philip Roth. They called me the English Philip Roth. I'd never read him. I had read Saul Bellow, and I was called Bellow as well. And I remember Malcolm Bradbury saying, in this novel you hear the bellow of Roth. And he liked that, and I liked that. But then I went on to read Philip Roth and thought, bloody hell, it's not bad being compared to him. He really is good. But I didn't, because I did my English literature degree in Cambridge. I studied under F.R. Leavis. As far as I was concerned, literature ended with the death of D.H. Lawrence in 1930. I wasn't reading Philip Roth. It was against my education to read Philip Roth. When I read Saul Bellow, I did it in secret, just in case any of my fellow Leavisites saw what I was reading. So I did feel I was, to begin with, very much working in the English tradition. I make a joke now that I'm not the English Philip Roth, I'm actually a Jewish Jane Austen. But actually, it was Jane Austen that I read and knew. I mean, I know Jane Austen much better than I knew Philip Roth. So I was working out of that tradition and only found myself like the Americans to my surprise. I got taken to the American experience from my own English Jewish experience. And then the Americans are quite bewildered by some of it, really, because they can't quite get what it is I'm up to, because they think they're doing it, but they're not. When Roth and Bellow work, they're working with Dostoevsky behind them and Kafka behind them, and they're in that slightly more fantastical, metaphorical tradition. I'm not in that tradition. I still am working with George Eliot. I mean, I want to sound like Henry James and Dr. Johnson. I really want to write periods like them. So I think my Jewishness comes out somewhat differently. And the problem of being an English Jew, there is a problem. The challenge of being an English Jewish writer is different to being an American Jewish writer, where if you're an American Jewish writer, your voice is already in the culture. I mean, why even bother to say American Jewish? If you're an American writer, you're a Jewish writer. There's no other way of being an American writer. You get occasional ones who think that, you know, that they could speak with it, that they're Gentiles, but they're not. Every writer in America is Jewish. Black or Jewish, or black and Jewish. You can't, but that's not so. That's not so in this. You have to carve your way. I'm not saying I've had this hard and lonely life carving my way out, but one does have to carve one's space for a Jewish voice in this culture in the way that you don't have to in America.
Just stay with the sort of Jewish voice of the narrator a bit more. I mean, by having this narrator, there's a certain kind of satirical irresponsibility that you can make him say things. So can I take a sentence?
Yes, please.
It's about one of his wives, Chloe, has been anally ravaged by a boyfriend because she wanted to go to art college. Goyim do that, they get upset, see red, hit the roof and take it out on you anally. Now, yes.
You have a problem with that?
No. I don't have a problem. I sort of laugh. I did laugh, I think, at that line.
But it goes on, doesn't it, about the Jewish aesthetic. I mean, what Jews don't do anything anally. Jews don't see the point of it. I mean, why do anally when there's something else that you could do? I mean, aesthetically, it's not what a Jew would choose to do. And also we have this thing called Habdalah. I mean, Habdalah is a very important concept for Jews. It's separation. One thing is not another thing. It goes right back to creation. God made this and God made that. And God made the anally thing and the other thing, and one was not meant to be confused with the other. A Jew doesn't do that kind of confusion. Okay. I do know this is a preposterous thing to say.
Yes. And he's part of the...
But you see what fun one can have if you're going to... you're not really meant to go there. You're not meant to talk about what races might want to anally ravage their wives. But the minute you do go there, it's play and it's preposterous, but it is also serious about how Jews are different. I mean, the fun I was having in this book was all the time moving in and out of what's serious and what's not serious, what's an outrageous thing to say, and what's an outrageous thing to say that nonetheless will shed light.
Chloe and Zoe, can we talk a bit about the wives? Because they're quite sort of, I mean, they're quite interchangeable, aren't they? I know they're different. Well, the reader gets a bit, has to try and remember which was first,
and
the chronology of the novel is such that actually it moves back and forth, so that you're not going to have any help from that.
You only find out why he married them and what they were like to be quite late. Yes, yeah. Something else I like doing. The inattentive reader might have difficulty seeing how they are, but they are. Part of the joke is that they are Chloe and Zoe, and they've got on the arts, and that's one of the reasons why he's married them. But Chloe marries him because she thinks he is a civilized person. She naively idealizes something Jewish in him, in which act of idealization there is an insult, if you like, in that she thinks he's not man enough to ravage her anally or any other way, and that he'll be a mild, quiet, loving husband. And she goes to the mild, quiet, loving husband and is perturbed to discover she meets something rather different. Zoe is another cup of tea, in that Zoe is actually Jew mad. Mm. Zoe takes him around the world to Holocaust sites and weeps. They meet when they're abroad, a couple of Germans, they're in Prague, I think, he's off with Zoe, and they meet a couple of Germans in Czechoslovakia who want to apologize for the Holocaust. Two young gay Czechs who want to say sorry for the... I mean, they had nothing to do with it, but everybody's drunk. And Zoe said, let them apologize. Let them. Please let them. It would be such a beautiful thing. And Max says, I can't accept an apology on somebody. First of all, they didn't do it. And second of all, it wasn't done to me. I can't accept an apology for anybody else. And she says, do it. Just do it for me. So he lets them apologize, and they kiss him, and we're really sorry for the Holocaust and thing. And Zoe is weeping. She said, this is the most beautiful and touching thing I've ever seen in my life. I mean, it's pure ludicrousness. But she is a person who, she loves the idea of Jewishness, which doesn't stop her also from wanting him to have a nose job.
The Holocaust preoccupation, which I guess is the thing that troubled most of the reviewers who were troubled by any of the book. But there are actually bits of narrative which are put in, which are in a different typeface and differently justified on the page. Narrative from the point of view of a Jewish prisoner in Buchenwald, and he's an artist, and the commandant's wife, infamous character, the bitch of Buchenwald, Ilse Koch, is humiliating him in this kind of weird, twisted, sexual manner.
Much of the book is sort of hinges upon the fact that the three boys who are at the centre of the book read Lord Russell of Liverpool's The Scourge of the Swastika when they're about 13 or 14. This is a real book which came out in the early 1950s, and I read with my boys I knew in the street. It was the first real account we had in England of the Holocaust and what had happened in the camps, and it had photographs in it. And we were deeply disturbed by this book, and this novel is, you could say, this novel is the record of that disturbance, or a comparable disturbance. And we were disturbed by it in many ways, but one of the ways that we were disturbed by it, and it seemed to me I had to be honest about, or anyway, I wished to be honest about this, was we were sexually disturbed by it. And it had photographs partly of, sometimes of naked Jewish women running through the camps. Now, you could say that no 14-year-old boy should feel anything about those photographs except I don't want to see them, they're too painful. But that's not to no 14-year-old boy. When you're a 14-year-old boy, and particularly then, probably be different if you're a 14-year-old boy now, because images of naked women's bodies are more available to you. And we didn't laugh at them, and we didn't go, you know, let's take those home and excite ourselves with them, but we acknowledged that they were a disturbance to us. On top of that, there was a sadomasochistic element, because many of these women who were talked about, the women who ran the camps, tortured the prisoners, the Jewish prisoners. And there was some very, very intimate accounts of how they tortured them. So this was something else that was disturbed us. But I discovered after this novel came out, actually, that a cache of comic books had been found that had been printed in Israel. There were sexual comic books, and they were about Jews reliving the torture that they experienced in the camp and reliving it as a sexual turn-on. And we all know perfectly well that, you know, that's how one of the ways we understand sexual perversion is that you often choose to have repeated what was done to you. If you're beaten up in public school, if you went to Eton and you were beaten up by a teacher, this will have its effect on you later on. We shouldn't be surprised to discover that the much more serious and horrific version of this has its effect on people. And it seemed to me it was something one had to throw in if one was really going to discuss this. The Holocaust, its effect on people, the obligation to remember it, or should we forget it, that whole thing at the centre of the book, what's remembering, what's forgetting, then you have to throw in the pain of the remembering. And one of the pains of the remembering is that it's the sexual disturbance in the mix.
And there are Holocaust jokes in this novel. They make the poor man buy a Volkswagen, and she says this terrible joke, you know, how many Jews can you fit in a Volkswagen? Why was it important to have not just the joking, which seemed to acknowledge things which maybe are true and really there and it's worth acknowledging, but jokes which do seem to just speak nastiness, really?
Well, because people do speak those nasty jokes. I grew up with those jokes. There was a vogue when I was growing up for sick jokes. We all told really, really sick jokes.
Yeah.
And I remember amongst ourselves, we told, you know, Jewish boys told terrible sick jokes like that. We might even have told that joke. I always forget jokes, so I actually went to sort of anti-Semitic sites to find, and I mean, you only have to go on internet, anti-Semitic jokes. You'll be surprised how much comes up.
Yeah.
Or you won't be surprised how much comes up. And there they all were, jokes which I either remembered or didn't remember. If you're going to take on the idea of comedy as being everything, as I do, if you're going to say that you have to approach, that nothing can't be approached in some way or other with comedy because jokes are important. This book is very, very much about joking. The refrain is Jew, 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 joke, 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 why, why. Then you can't sort of stop at a certain moment and go, but I'm not going near those jokes. If you're going to think that jokes have a curative effect, then you have to test that. I'm not saying those jokes have a curative effect, but you have to test it, and you have to look, I mean, not to have looked at the worst kind of jokes that Jews make about themselves or that are made about Jews would have been to have failed, you know, one of the ambitions of this book, which was to look at, to test joking out, to submit the worst, the most recent horrific Jewish experience to jokes. I'm not asking you to laugh at those, I'm just saying, behold them.
Yeah.
Behold them, these are the jokes that are made. What are we going to do with these in this rich mix of a book in which the hero is a cartoonist, in which we are talking about forgetting all the time? What's the obligation? And remember, it's called Kaluki Nights. It's a game. The novel begins with Max describing the period he had very unsuccessfully trying to copy Tom of Finland cartoons. I don't know whether you know Tom of Finland. They're kind of, I don't know how much time you spend in gay bookshops, but they are the best-selling.
That was the most recondite book.
Yes. Well, I'm surprised because I didn't realise I spent time in gay books. These are just things you sort of see. I live in Soho. This may have something to do with it. But these are hugely best-selling books of men with biceps romping around with one another, and they wear Nazi hats and things, and they have bulging muscles. And Max can't draw them because he can't draw the bulge. Actually, it doesn't go with his culture to actually do bulging men in leather, because he's never worn leather. He explains that Jewish men wear light-fitting trousers and the cardigan. They don't wear denim and leather. But there's a speculation on page one about how these men are all playing as though it's in paradise. These gay men who beat one another up are actually frolicking. And it's a frolic that's not open to him. He said, Jews don't do frolic. It's not possible. It's, you know, when the gates of paradise closed for a Jew, that was the end of it. There was no more fun. The injunction on being Jewish was to be deadly serious. And yet somewhere or other, as we know, Jews invented this. I mean, I'm assuming we're all agreed that whoever invented a joke, he was Jewish. The joke, and a joke is a Jewish sort of invention for when it's a joke that deals with horror. It's how, that's how Jews have negotiated it. And Jews amongst themselves will joke about absolutely anything. The more horrific, the more they will joke about it. So this is a novel about playing and not playing. Kaluki Nights is a game. Max is furious with his mother because she plays this game. Why are you playing this game when you should be a serious... What happened to us? What happened to being seriously Jewish? He says at one point, which is mad. Why shouldn't she play a card game? But he has got mad with the business of, in the business of being Jewish, obsessively Jewish, thinking about it, thinking about the joking or the not joking. He's gone mad with it. So I think, you know, anything to do with joking is fair game here. There can't be a bad taste joke.
Okay,
I could have been braver.
Even braver.
Even braver.
I want to ask you one more question. It is a novel which has lots of episodes and anecdotes, but in a way doesn't have a plot.
A driving plot. No, yeah. I abominate plot.
You abominate that principle.
I love story, yes. Yeah. I've never had the slightest interest in a plot. I don't read thriller stories, I don't read mystery stories.
But you read Dickens novels, they have plots.
Yeah, but I struggle with the plots. Oh. And I don't really... The only plot I really like is Great Expectations, where the plot's got ironic meaning. I just don't want to know. I mean, I am of the Henry James school. Henry James says somewhere or other, that if a woman is taking a cup of tea and she looks through a window and sees another woman crossing the lawn wearing something or other, and their eyes meet, you have all you need of a story. You know, that's all you need of a story. Nothing need happen at all. It's all in the texture of the writing. I would read a novel and enjoy a novel in which nothing happens whatsoever, because something always must happen, because one sentence follows another. How wonderful that sentence follows that. How did that sentence beget that sentence? Look what the comma's doing. Do you think the comma's going to fall in love with the semicolon? Do you think who did it? The exclamation mark did it.
I wonder how much the preposterousness of your book is claiming that horrible Jewish joke so that it's ours instead of theirs, so that it can't hurt us anymore.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think you're dead right. We will take it into ourselves exactly. So, I couldn't agree more with you. That's the feature of a Jewish joke anyway, often itself, that a Jewish joke works this way. You abuse us, you beat us, you kick us out, but we will, and you're as cruel to us as you can possibly be, but we will be even crueler. We will beat you because we will be more vile to ourselves than you can possibly be. So therefore, we have won. And how have we won? And this is the dangerous aspect of a Jewish joke. We've won by being smarter.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.